from the day two of Widget Summit. Our first talk this morning is from Andreas Wijgen. Andreas is the former chief scientist of Amazon.com. If you've ever been to Amazon and seen some of the recommendations there, you might like this, or we recommend these items for you. Andreas is probably instrumenting that and figuring out what exactly you do like in order to sell more things. And these days, Andreas is traveling all over the world helping companies understand their data that they collect from users every single day and how to turn that data into monetizable assets. Very relevant to the widget world, which is one of his interests. How do you take all different sensor networks you've placed in the widget sense and take advantage of all the data they're collecting every single day to drive your business decisions? How can widgets influence your business decisions just based on the data that they collect and the relationships and engagements that they take part of? So Andreas, thank you.
Now, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. And it is actually not only the data they collect anyways, but it's also helping companies figure out what data they ought to be collecting. So coming out with a data strategy means figuring out what could they be collecting. Sometimes I say that the problem in the last decade was, given a set of data, what insights can you get? And that has shifted. Now the problem has become, given a problem, what data can you obtain? So what we're going to do here in the next 45 minutes is we are looking at widgets as a large sensor network, and we're going to figure out what is it that we can collect, what is it that we can do with that, what problems can we solve. Sometimes I say, in 5 years, there won't be an Amazon.com anymore. And of course, I don't mean that the company won't exist. But I mean that maybe it is not primarily that we'll go to the website, Amazon.com, where we are going to buy stuff. But all over the place, there will be widgets which allow us to, wherever we are, to get what we want to get. Okay, in our talk, I'll start giving you two widgets which I think are good examples of data collection. One of them is called Virtual Tourists, and the other one is called Flickr Badge. You probably know those. Then I generalize up from those specific two examples to what, in my opinion, really is happening in the current time, which I call the consumer data revolution. What do you mean by that? It is first the passive collection of data. Second, it's that people actually actively give you data about themselves. Think Facebook. And thirdly, it is that people now give you data about the connections between people, which is our beautiful example, and I'll walk you through the different actors in that game. We then talk about how the attitude of people is changing what they want to get in exchange to the data they're giving you. And I will then move to the last part of the talk, where I'm going to talk about data strategies. Data strategies means what actually can you do to satisfy the changing needs and the changing expectations of consumers, for instance, how they want to move from pure transaction economics to a genuine relationship economics. What can you do to reduce the information asymmetry, for instance, to allow consumers to also look into your company with a widget and feel that they are not getting cheated, feel that they are having no regret about, for instance, the purchases they made. I will give you a few brief examples which are not from the widget world and ask us then together that we'll figure out, well, what can we learn from these examples? Some of them I'm sure are new for you. And then I'll conclude with what I see as the trends. Okay, let's get started. Here is a Facebook page. Unfortunately, yesterday I didn't manage to get it to work. I don't know why IFB wasn't displaying anything. Normally what you see here is a nice map. So this is my friend's Ghost page, and it allows you to compare friends. That means it allows me to look at his data and say, hey, these are places where he's been to, and that's the place where I've been to, and it gives me some ideas about what we have in common, some conversation points. Side remark. Here you notice that widget allows you to actually solicit feedback from people. Under this ad, the future of marketing, purchase, join the conversation today to find out more, etc. Now, Facebook asks us to actually give it feedback, very different from a traditional ad where you don't know whether somebody actually read it or didn't. Question, of course, is what does it do with feedback? And if you are in that group which has this as an example, I invite you to see what those options are. It turns out that something at 0.1% of the people actually give it negative feedback, about the same percentage as the click-through rate on ads. Okay, so then here it said on this one that he's not happy about traffic on election day, but we'll be back in time for the result, go vote. Yesterday, I was utmostly surprised when at my class at Berkeley, I saw here, this is my course wiki, a pathetic yes on Prop 8. So once you open up for other content, you might not always be seeing what you want to see. And as you know, that the people behind Proposition 8, I'm not sure how many of you vote in California, have put enormous amount of money into it, that even at a class at Berkeley on the consumer data revolution, the future of relationships, it prompts an ad by the religious right. Then, of course, you look at Twitter, who actually is, what are people saying who use the web, and from that this morning, 2 minutes ago, it didn't look quite as bad, so no one ate, I hope, has a chance. In any case, back to widgets. Virtualtourist.com is one example I wanted to walk you through. There is here a person, I don't know her, and she has been to 32 countries and shared 603 trips and reviews. So the idea is that you make yourself a widget which you display anywhere. For instance, here you go to the page, it says create your own travel map, key ingredient here. Create your own map is always the way to get people to actually do widget distribution for you. And then you mouse over it. For this case here, I mouse over Singapore, where I was last week. And then I can have three actions. Number one is, it is places where I have been. Number two is, even deeper than that, places where I have lived at. And the third one is, much more interesting from an e-commerce perspective, places I want to go to. So, from a data collection device, let's see what's happening here. You collect intention by people. You know who these people are. And that allows you to then, for instance, in this case, give them hotel searches because they just told you that they want to go to place X. And if it's in a place like Facebook where this widget was displayed, it also allows you to rank their friends in terms of the location. So we have two ways of monetizing this here. One is a lame United Airlines ad on the right, and the other one less lame by one time, which is one of the travel comparison sites, directly a form. Now, if you did this better, you would, of course, pre-fill the form. If the person says they want to go to Singapore, you put it in Singapore already to make it more relevant. The second example does precisely that already very well, and that is Flickr. So just to be clear, a widget is nothing but a piece of code which you embed somewhere. Now, there are a number of ingredients which get us to that piece of code. So that's, for instance, from my homepage. What does it refer to? It refers to a thing like this. I want to walk you through the different ingredients in this data collection device called widget. First, where do you actually make that widget? In this case, you make it on flickr.com/batch.gne, and something amazing happens. As you're logged in with your Yahoo account or your Flickr account, and you go to that page, you immediately get drawn in because you say, hey, gee, I mean, these pictures look familiar. Actually, that's me. How is it possible that Yahoo, and this is, again, me with the CEO of Baidu there. So you realize that Flickr does a good job in right away actually engaging the user by showing them pictures of their own photos, which they have actually taken. So if I was not logged in and I entered, say, Singapore as a location, they, and I'm not sure what they're doing, if I was them, I would show random pictures which are tagged by Singapore, which have as geolocation Singapore. So you make it way more relevant by having this dynamic content given the situation or given the things which I know about the user. Okay, number one is, where do I go to make the widget? Ingredient two is, where does the content get pulled from? So in this case, it's from my Flickr stream, flickr.com/photos/aweigand. And well, that's just where it could be, but I could also pull it from Niall's page. So any public photos, for instance, in this case, are fair game. Then the next question is, where do you put the widget? So when we talk about instrumenting the world, we now actually have first, where do you make it? One website, could be Image Loop, could be Slide, could be Flickr here. Second one is, where does the content come from? Basically anywhere in case of pictures here from Flickr. And the third one, where do I place it? And I place it on weigand.com/misc. So now here is this live thing which just shows you pictures in real time. There are a couple of more questions. Who might help you distribute the widget? So this one is probably of not that much interest for the rest of the world to display my pictures, so somewhat limited distribution to be expected. But if you have an ad which you want the world to see, then you talk to companies who are in the job of doing widget distribution. So it's like if you have sensors, you want to have distributed in the world. If it's just one sensor to measure temperature in your house, you put it out yourself. But if you want to actually have a feeling about what is the temperature grid in the United States, you find people who actually do that for you. Next ingredient is who actually clicks on the widget. Once again, the person in this case comes to weigand.com and clicks on this probably has nothing to do with me. It might be you right now trying out what's happening then, and that is Lex's last point here. Where does a click on the widget take them? So two things make sense here. One is it takes them to my pictures, and the other one is taking it to make your own, to the strategy of viral distribution. You see something, and there you are, and now your pictures are shown as you're going to investigate what this is about. So in all these cases, you have opportunities to actually measure stuff. What we are measuring here is simple clicks, but you could, of course, having distributed these widgets to different places, understand how differentially do they work. You can vary the content and do a lot of experimental design to understand in real time what actually it is that you want to show. Okay, the last question here is actually, who are you who creates the widget? And that, I think, really outlines the universe of different actors which we have. Okay, so for me, widgets are an example of going from e-business where the firm is in the center and reaches out, targets potential consumers, to me business, where I'm in the center, and hey, it's my content which is displayed on my page, not some random ad like this yes on Proposition 8, which was shown on my Berkeley page. So when I thought about what are the four ingredients of this me business, I think the first one genuinely is that user focus, customer focus. That, you know, you all know the term Web 2.0, that when you really think about it, it is that the user is in the center. That, for many companies, actually takes a while to comprehend in its entirety. People always think that, you know, customer is king, but what that really means takes a while to sink in. So for instance, this notion of customer relationship management is by many of them used to be pretending that it is already something where the customer is taken care of, that there's a relationship. But if you think about, for instance, your, say, the relationship with your airline, it consists about, you know, most of us living in San Francisco, getting a card once a year by United, it says 1K on it, and they think they have a relationship with us, but hey, they're holding us hostage because we don't have much choice. So there is not much voluntary relationship here. In a user-focused me business world, it is more like, some people call it vendor relationship management, where you put out your interests. I would love to have a romantic hotel in San Francisco for this weekend. Hey, make me offers, dear hotels. And that dramatically shifts from some, you know, Four Seasons sending me an offer about a new hotel opening up in Malaysia, which, you know, I'll probably not go next weekend to hey, this is where I want to go, and please help me out. Very different, which goes from a click-through rate of whatever, 0.1%, to being impressed that somebody is actually meeting my needs on my terms as opposed to me trying to meet their needs on their terms. Second point. If I think about my computer, it's funny, but the more I use it, the slower it becomes. I don't know why. Maybe other people don't have that experience, but it takes longer to boot and stuff. On the other hand, if you think about Google, if you think about Amazon, if you think about companies which are data-intensive companies which actually learn from the data, the more people use them, the better they become. Very interesting how in those two cases, the dial goes the other way. So when I want to think about this here, the question is, what do you need to do that you get better with use by users as opposed to worse over time? And that can be better on average, or it can be in the sense of personalization, which is an interesting discussion by itself, better for the individual. So how can we engineer the system that it improves over time by leveraging user data? Third point is, how can we use the viral effects by deploying widgets in the world? So I told you that this make your own strategy, of course, is always part. And it is that we don't have just supply side economies of scale, but demand side economies of scale. Network effects, as economists call it. And then the fourth part is that of data strategy, that users create the value. So it's not that the user is your enemy and you try to show him as little as possible, but you genuinely create a reason for them to share their data with you. I usually say that has to happen within 30 seconds that they see that value. It is amazing how, you know, good companies still don't get this. Let me give you an example. Since I just talked about United, United prints on the boarding passes that you can go to ualsurvey.com, and I thought that's absolutely awesome that they again instrument the world by here's your boarding pass. Now they ask me, hey, how was it and what could you improve and so on and so forth. So with energy, full of enthusiasm, you go to the website and first thing you fill out is your frequent flyer number, 00227149000. All right. Now you think they should actually know who I am because there's only one person with that Mileage Plus number. So you go to the next page and says, so please tell us your name. Well, you should know my name. Please tell us your address. Why do you know my address? Please tell us the flight number. I mean, hey, dude, I mean, I just, you know, gave you my number. You should have my records because if I go to the website, there it is. And what class of service do you fly? Which day do you fly? Which day do you? And at that stage, they lost me. Why do they not do it right? Well, the answer, of course, is because the people who outsource the survey to have no idea about the frequent flyer number, and it's just not from a world which is sort of an instrumented widget world, but it's coming from a paper world where, you know, you have no responsiveness of the system, where you can't feed new data in given of the answers you get. Another example, which I think is a good example here, is, of course, Google Maps, where another beautiful idea for widget, where you allow users to create value by saying, hey, that little mark for the office of contagion, for instance, seeing Albert there, is a little bit off. So within 200 meters, you are actually allowed to move that mark. So you suddenly have millions of people who collect and who correct the data, which in this case, Google has on the maps. Let me give you another example of maps. As you know, a year ago, Navteq was acquired by Nokia for about $8.3 or $8.6 billion. Navteq took $300 million to reach break-even. That's a lot of money, a lot of money. Why? Because they are employing about 1,000 people who are doing nothing but driving with their cars and their GPSs through the world. So that was the traditional model of data business, that you employ people whose job it is to get those data. Now, Nokia, this year alone, sold 100 million mobile phones with GPS devices. So we had 1,000 people driving versus 100 million people. That's, you know, a big factor, 10 to the 5. In addition, if you have 10 to the 5 more, you can actually make good statements about the, what I call empirical density. You know where those people are driving, and if nobody drives there because it's whatever, some military base, you probably don't have to worry about the roads there. So the approach, rather than having a centralized way of telling people, you know, which roads to map out, you just throw the sensors in the world, and back come the data, and you make sense out of the world. Side remark, if you actually have those sensors out there, and I want you in your minds to think about the transfer you could make from this to the widget world, then instead of having complicated calculations, which we did at Xerox PARC 15 years ago, about whether the flow on 101 between San Francisco and Palo Alto is laminar or turbulent to figure out whether we need to leave the office early or not, hey, once you have the sensors out there, you just simply measure GPS or base stations, how far are the cars moving in front of me, and you're set. That was another example for how the question of the 90s, given a set of data, what insights can you get, has been shifted to the question, given a problem, why do you need to leave home, what data can I get? Okay, so these are examples, I think, of what it means to go from what I call e-business to me business. So, at the heart of all of this, and forward-looking here, is that we are in the middle of a consumer data revolution. So many companies initially want to just sniff that digital exhaust. People leave. Those traces they leave, and those patterns actually are, of course, interesting and allow us to draw conclusions from. These are mainly implicit data, and what's new here is that there are many more implicit data which we're collecting compared to, say, 10 years ago, geolocation being one good example. However, widgets allow us to radically think and rethink that strategy by basically simply asking people what they really want. An interesting widget, a shopping widget, was developed by a German company called Otto Group, O-T-T-O. They visited me the July 4th weekend last year for a few days, and a number of projects came out of it. Among those, a project which does social shopping, so it's Match.com. And I can, for instance, put from their catalog, let's say, two shirts into a widget, just drag and drop in the top right. And now I can ask my friends, hey, what shirt do you think looks better on me? So what you have is you have a strategy where I can express, not based on my past purchasing behavior, but based on my current intentions, and ask my friends, do viral market and all of that for that company, and ultimately for myself. So what's happening is two things. One is I am expressing things explicitly as opposed to them just looking at my click streams. Two is the social element comes in that I'm not only saying these are attributes about myself, but I'm saying these are my friends and this is the quality of the relationships we have. So these are three things. The first one, just to repeat, was what are properties you can infer based on my behavior? Many companies are trying to exhaust that digital exhaust, if you will. The second one is, what am I willing to tell you about myself? Dating sites are a good example where people say, you know, this is who I am, this is who I'm looking for, or this is who I pretend to be. And then the third example is much more powerful, what are the links I have to other people? The reason I showed you earlier on those ingredients into a widget is that the links are very intrinsically present there already. Like somebody uses my pictures on their website and yet another person clicks on that. You actually right away are in those relationships as opposed to into the attributes business. So people reveal their relationships with others and don't make the mistake to think that we are there yet. The fact that on Facebook, for instance, those relationships are either presence or absence, i.e. binary, is a way oversimplification. Relationships, first of all, are asymmetrical. I might like that person much more than they like me. And a beautiful company called Skydeck looks at the implicit patterns in my callings between people and makes them explicit. They look up my phone records, my mobile phone records. I give them my phone number, my carrier, and my password there. And then they give back to me insights, making the implicit explicit. And it's quite interesting. So I actually encourage you to play with that and see what you learn from that. And they are multidimensional. So we do different things with different people. And this is all way more complex than just having either a friend or not having a friend. Now, not that Facebook wouldn't know these things, but it's not easy, actually, to go from the implicit things which we can learn, how long does it hit for somebody to respond, to the explicit things. And it's not obvious for Facebook what actions they can really take. So at the heart is here the consumer data revolution, that the expectations are shifting, that the attitude of individuals to the information they provide is shifting in the sense that they want to see something in return to the information they're giving. Let's return to the example of the Nokia phones. Right now, I hear some people actually are paying for their dash devices, which is something like a GPS thing in the car, which tells you, you know, how the traffic is. But they wouldn't know how the traffic was even if people didn't have their dash devices. So my question now is, of the shifting expectations, who pays whom? Hey guys, you have an information product, great, but you wouldn't have it without me. So let's actually talk about this. Maybe I give you the 10, 20 first hits a day for free, but if you want more than that, but please not in a 5-mile radius of my best friend, then you need to pay me. And you could pay me maybe not in money, but in other things. You could make my life simpler, you could help me discover things, you could do all kinds of stuff. So it's not just, when I talk economics, it's not just about money, but it is about whatever the scarcities are of the time. And one of our scarcities certainly is that we have attention as a scarce good. So talking about attention here, while in the United.com survey example, I felt my attention violated. I felt that they asked me things they shouldn't ask me and they didn't let me get to what I really wanted to tell them. And those companies who use the implicit data to show the relevant stuff in widgets, those are the ones, I think, who have the positive attitude from consumers, and those are the ones consumers are willing to share their attention with. So I now want to walk you through 5, 6, 7 quick examples of how, in some cases like this one, widgets already exist. In other cases, I want to spark your neurons here to fire a little bit, and then I want to have a discussion with you what we could make out of that. First example here is Flickr. We talked about it, where you, of course, get people to interact. Tags, in this case, Esther Dyson, took a picture and says, you know, I'm a secret weapon of many companies currently. And, you know, immediately my friend Ming Yao comments here and says, yeah, it's certainly the best way to describe Andreas. So here you have interactions already. Learning about interactions is always very, very interesting for me. Second point is, if you look at how communication has changed in the last 20, 30 years, for me, that is the main change in business. That it's now basically free to communicate with people. And it used to be that there were, you know, a few million people in the 70s who lived in the back end, digitized the back end, those processes. In the 80s, the front office started interacting with the back end, maybe 100 million people. In the 90s, still not that exciting. Now actually a billion people actually managed to poke to the front end. What is interesting is here the right-hand side, where people interact with the system, not only by poking at it, but by also contributing content. And I should say there's 100 million plus people who actually produce content now. Four consequences of this. One is discovery is the name of the game now. It's not just search. Search means you look for something which you know exists. Discovery is where the interesting things are happening. how can we help with instrumenting the world, collecting data, getting people to tell us stuff so we give them stuff back which they didn't expect to find. People, instead of pages, you know, Web 1.0 is about pages, Web 2.0 is about people. Third, mobile. If you talk about data collection devices, the most intimate collection device all of us have is, of course, the mobile phone. So widgets living on the mobile, if you connect them with geolocation, or if you push further, if you actually have them record the sound, understand who is talking, or are there, you know, flickering images, are we in a movie, or how fast are we moving? Are we moving with others, i.e. we're on the train? Are we just, you know, walking on the street? It knows so much about my situation. It even knows, am I late? Because it knows where I ought to be, 9 o'clock my talk here, but I'm still in Muni at 8:55. So it knows this might not be the right time to actually interrupt me with something. And finally, stuff which allows us to model the current situation plus history, sensing. First example in sensing is here a company which looks at my behavior. Company not far away from here, just Summit Hill. IMMI, Integrated Media Measurement Incorporated. Here's how it works from their website. You grab a phone, and every 30 seconds, that phone makes a phone call. And what it talks in that phone call to headquarters is, it talks what you have been doing. So it listens for 10 seconds to what's in the room, computes stuff from that, and then says, guess what? 7:31, Niall is in the shower. 7:31 and 30 seconds, Niall is in the shower. 7:32, Niall is in the shower. 7:32 and 30 seconds, Niall is in the shower. 7:48, Niall is still in the shower, clearly a candidate for a separate conditioner and shampoo. Okay. My behavior. My camera and my microphone. As I prepared for a talk at the Web 2 Expo, this ad came up. It asked me, hey, do you allow S3 Amazon and Amazon Web.com to access your camera and microphone? What's that? And after thinking for a moment, of course, because that way, the content I get piped in my box is much more appropriate. It knows whether, for instance, I am sitting there by myself, maybe with somebody, maybe I am actually in the kitchen fixing myself dinner. So, interesting, huh? That's 1 billion devices in the world which can sense what's going on by listening and by viewing about what's happening. 1 billion Adobe Flash players. Third example is about my information. Well, I'm actually very open with my information. I gave a distinguished lecture at Berkeley a couple of months ago with the title Digital Exhibitionism, which actually was given to me by the German parliament guy who is in charge of data protection because he called me on television in, you know, not knowing a better word, a digital exhibitionist, just because I had my mobile number on the phone. By the way, how many people do you think call if your number is on your page? The anchor woman points out, unbelievable, he has his mobile number on the page. 4 people called, you know, who haven't talked to me for a couple of years. So that's about the extent of, you know, how people actually use those things. So here's a company called Jigsaw. What Jigsaw does is it allows you to trade information. So if you really want to know Niall's mobile number, hey, check it out in Jigsaw. And actually, there's a correction mechanism in it that if you call the number and it turns out it's Domino's Pizza, that you actually don't have to give your points for that. So information which you thought was private is no longer private. So total loss of control. Next example is here, my data. So who of you would be willing to sort of let me look at the hard drive? You? Are you sure? I think the other day somebody from Geek Squad came to my house and they said everybody has sort of some stuff they are not so comfortable for people. I mean, I don't mean looking at the box. I mean looking at the files, yeah? So most people would be somewhat unhappy if, you know, somebody starts poking around their computer. Interesting question, would you be more unhappy if you saw somebody's search queries or if you saw somebody's short messages? I mean, these are all very personal things. So here's an example of a company called Illumio down in Palo Alto. And it is just a much better way, because they actually have a good relevance function, of doing what, for instance, Yahoo Answers does. Namely, you have a question. And just to recall the history of this, you know that in Korea, where you don't have that much content in Korean language, a Naver wasn't all that successful web search because you didn't find much. So they allowed people to post questions, and now Koreans actually answer those questions, and it's very much a social thing which then went through Southeast Asia and exists also as Yahoo Answers. But the big problem is sort of relevance. What data do I have to actually get questions which I'm interested in, I'm competent in answering? And the answer is, you know, you get random questions if you don't have additional information about me. So what Illumio does is it scans my entire hard drive, or in other words, it actually uses, in my case, Microsoft Indexer to figure out what I have, doesn't give that information out, but sees with a basic standard dot product what actually are the matches between questions and my documents. And the first question I got was here from some person who is at the same school I'm teaching at, plus had a question about something which was, you know, very relevant, Amazon's statistically improper phrase. I was just amazed how out of the many, many questions they're getting, a question which I am pretty confident in being able to answer, get this, and not many other questions I would not be particularly competent in answering them. So that's my data. My car. Having a GPS in the car means that we can have fairer pricing. If I don't drive, I don't have to pay car insurance. But the interesting issue is there that what happens if just before an accident you drive too fast? Will the car insurance say, well, hey, if you're driving 80 miles an hour, you won't expect, and have just been breaking the law, you're not expecting us to, you know, step in and pay for your accident? And actually turned out that they stopped this program a couple of months ago. The other countries, for instance, United Arab Emirates, where you have to have a GPS device, and if you speed, they automatically take money out of your bank account. So that really changed behavior. If, you know, basically it's your choice. If you're late for a meeting, you do the rational calculation. How much is it worth it for you to, you know, be 5 minutes late, and you decide whether or not to go a little bit faster, and you pay for it right away. Now it gets interesting. My DNA. So here, 23andMe, for $400, you can have your DNA sequenced, and you learn all kinds of things about yourself. But the most interesting part here is the 23andMe, that there are tens of thousands of people who paid themselves for having a DNA sequenced, who are now actually happy to be subjects for all kinds of questions. For instance, how many glasses of wine does it take for your nose to turn red? Well, ultimately, that has to do something with DNA, because, you know, some enzymes break down the alcohol, etc. So very interesting how this community-based approach changes the way research is done and, of course, opens up ways for personalized medicine. Again, a problem here in data strategy is what should be my personal data strategy? Because if in 20 years from now, some smart-ass health insurance comes and say, hey, Andreas, given your little snippet in your DNA here, we think about this, you know, is in for the books for you, and you have to pay twice the insurance premium. So as open as I am about my data, I worry about what's happening down the road there, and I would not actually release my DNA sequence. Next, another example here is I read about it in The Economist, I don't know the people personally, a girl who was anorexic. The health insurance didn't want to pay for her. And then her mom said, but look, I have paid health insurance. My poor daughter, she goes to hospital once a day or whatever. It's about $1,000. I don't have the money. I can't pay $30,000 a month. And the health insurance told her, well, you can sue us. And mom said, well, you know, I have no choice here. And then the first thing the health insurance did is they collected all the MySpace data, Facebook data, everything the girl had said, her IMs, tried to get to her emails, just to prove things in this asymmetry, in this that actually they don't have to pay. So, yeah, interesting points about data. So here I mentioned Skydeck beforehand. Skydeck looks at my implicit calling patterns, and it tells me that my top 10 conversations last week was with Go, and so on and so forth. And very smart. They understand also who I should be inviting. For instance, here it says, invite Tom G to join Skydeck. It, of course, knows the names from my Outlook, which I once said, you know, I don't look at the numbers. I'm not that good in remembering 4,000 telephone numbers, but show me my names. And why did they pick Tom here out of the 4,000 people? Probably other friends of Tom use Skydeck, and he has appeared a number of times, and that's why they know he's a better candidate as a VC in the consumer space than people who, you know, only show up once in the Skydeck network. And more examples. All of these are things where basically the world is instrumented for us to collect data. Here are a couple of examples of companies I've worked with in a data strategy way, and I'm happy in the discussion to give you more examples, so quickly run through them. In the B2B space, Alibaba, I worked with actually in the early days, helping Jack Ma to instrument the company to really know what is going on. Because in China, as you know, not everything is as transparent as it is or to be in the West. And by understanding what really, for instance, are return rates, how do people behave, is a significant part for the success. Traditional retail. I worked through the conversation group with Best Buy earlier this year, and that was hard work because it is a very traditional company. They're based in the Midwest, and you know Best Buy, $40 billion revenues last year. And I was absolutely impressed when Peter Hirschberg, who also is the conversation group, interviewed at Google's Zeitgeist the CEO of Best Buy. And it's a movie you can actually get to easily on Google. The guy says, we are one wiki. So that was a big shift in thinking from, hey, you know, we have a catalog and you can write an API to get to the data, to we allow all employees to open their own stores, virtual stores. If you're an expert in Wii games, be my guest. You have a little store and you sell Wii games because you really love that part. And then to allow users to annotate stuff as they're in the show and potentially also as they are in the competing store. Just maybe another couple of examples here. Agoda is Priceline in Asia. Thai Singaporean company understands extremely well in their travel widgets how to understand demand. If you take any individual hotel, you know, how many people call in a given day? X. So now you have a city like San Francisco where you have maybe 1,000 hotels, maybe 100 hotels, I don't know. So your error bar, your statistical error, is of the order of a few percent of how well you manage to predict demand compared to if you're in an individual hotel. So the data collection strategy has shifted from trying to understand from the visitor's bureau when the next convention is, and then adjusting your prices to simply, not externally, but internally, look at what's coming in. And based on the queries you get, to say, okay, we know something is happening there because many people are actually interested in querying, can I get a hotel from this date to that date in that category? And based on that, you build your own pricing strategy. Maybe one example of loyalty here is if you think about Miles & More, which is like Mileage Plus or whatever the programs are called in the United States, there hasn't been much innovation in these loyalty programs in the last 10 years. But we now live in a much greater, richer world where people are willing to show their preferences if they see something in return. So if I can describe what kind of person I would like to sit next to on my next 10-plus hour flight, and actually that will happen, that I have quality time, that I meet a person who I really like, hey, I'm willing to spend as much time as needed to describe of who I'm interested in, to the degree that we actually know who we're interested in, that to the degree we know our preferences. But if they're just asking about what's the income of your household, why would I want to tell them that? So I think rather than giving you many more examples here, let's summarize what data actually can be doing here. Widgets allow us to collect much richer data than the traditional clickstream analysis which we had. Examples are forwarding here, telling you about my place I want to visit, annotating things which are a measure of my attention, searching for stuff in other ways, measure of intention, monetizable. You know the location, maybe geolocation, maybe actually IP location. And putting all this data together with people, social recommendations, which could be either friends, meaning specific people you know, or it could be your peers. If you have 8 children and they're looking for a car in the city, then probably other people with 8 children looking for a car in the city are a good source of information, better than calling up a car dealer. It could be also experts, people, self-aware experts who are fashion bloggers, fashions, for instance, made. So taking all of this together is a very different world from what we had before this data revolution. Three slides to end. One is, how has the data business changed? The traditional business was that you pay experts to collect data. The new business that people give you data and you have to think about a value exchange. Data are worth as much as the decisions they change are. So if decision doesn't depend on a piece of data, you should pay nothing for those data. Most decisions, maybe except religion, actually do depend on data. And so if you think about it this way, then having a distributed sensor network which allows you to collect all kinds of stuff helps you make better decisions, and that is monetizable. Maybe one example I want to pull out here is the multiple listing service question, what house do I buy? Where we had this traditional model of paying 6% of the price of the house, 3%, to some, you know, pretty much random people. And instead of that, if you think Zillow, Redfin, Trulio, and other companies, you now actually have people with widgets bidding on other people's houses and just playing around and creating liquidity market which wouldn't have existed beforehand. So finally, how is the business changing? Who talks to whom? It's pretty much consumers talking to consumers. When you say conversational marketing, it's not a brand having a conversation. Like Fidelity sends me this statement saying, a conversation with your fund manager. Never met the guy. What are they talking about? Conversation? Not a conversation in my sense of talking to someone, of a dialogue. So it's consumers talking to consumers. Actually, who trusts whom? It turns out that the trust consumers have in brands, in shops, in your government, in healthcare is pretty pathetically low. There's a roundtable I had with Esther Dyson and Shoshana Zuboff at Fortune Magazine's Brainstorm Tech Conference, and I have the MP3 and the transcript on my page. Shoshana gives all those numbers, and they don't look good for this country. So who is in control? Well, it used to be that companies thought they are in control, but ultimately, it's the consumers in control now. Because if you want to learn something about a certain item, Google, i.e. the world, knows more about that item than the people who actually produce that item. Who manages whom? It used to be that companies through information asymmetry try to manage / manipulate you. Has changed. In many cases, consumers are able to find out stuff, and they are no longer able to get screwed as easily as before. What are the new metrics? That's, of course, something very close to my heart. Self-metrics actually often drive behavior. Yelp, Y-E-L-P, is a wonderful example of a company which has this great self-metrics, telling you, you have 17 restaurants, you were the first one to review, things where people actually can make a change to appear there. Nothing monetary about this. And a good conversation to have is actually try to find out, why do people do things? And then finally, the question about who pays whom. I gave you a couple examples of where the sign even is unclear who should be paying, and what this is about is to design incentives so consumers participate and interact. That's what I wanted to do. We have a few minutes left for questions and for discussion. So may I turn over and ask you for comments or to share what that triggered, what neurons fired in your brains at this early time in the day. Anybody wants to be first? Thank you.
Wow. You do this for a living. You said you could get data for ads, content like Flickr photo screen. What are other examples that you take, you might be able to draw from to do something like that?
Basically, what you're doing is you're instrumenting the world of placing little detectors pretty much anywhere. So if you think about your mobile phone, which, as you know, is my favorite example, except your underwear, basically nothing is closer to you than your mobile, only the sky is the limit. Let me give you an example. Here in San Francisco, parking sometimes is a problem. Parking is not easy. A study out of UCLA has shown that apparently, 30% of all traffic in Los Angeles are people looking for parking spots. So other countries have a different approach to this. For instance, I also have a house in Shanghai. And Shanghai, you reserve your parking spot on the web. So not that I wouldn't want to drive in Shanghai, but that's how you do it. You go on the web, you say, I want to park here from 10:15 to 12 o'clock, and you pay in a rich approach, auction-based approach. You pay whatever it takes, they take it out of your account, and there's your spot. Now, Berkeley has an interesting project where they instrumented San Francisco, and I just want to show it, to show you the trade-offs here. On the one hand, it will tell you that there's a parking spot over there, and it will save your time also if there's no parking spot of driving around for half an hour. On the other hand, there's this pesky 2-hour parking rules, I'm not sure whether you've heard about them, that every 2 hours when you're with a client, you have to go out and feed the meter, which of course is illegal, which makes no sense to me why it should be illegal. You know, if I rent the space, why can't I do it? Anyways, and now, of course, they know extremely well, through having instrumented the city, that you have been there for 2 hours and 1 minute, and there comes the ticket. So that's just one example of, you know, you lose privacy, you increase efficiency, and you have to decide yourself on where you want to come out on that front.
So we're out of time. We have to set up for the next session.
Yeah, we're already in the questions. Yeah. One more question, and then.
Oh, this is just a follow-up on what you said. So isn't another issue the fact that if everyone wants to use that, it would fail because everyone would go to the same spots?
Not if you have a rich way
of reserving
it.
Okay, reserve.
So the big problem is that we haven't embraced the richness of communication for many things. Last night at the great dinner we were at, Niall's wonderful dinner, we discussed how pathetic it is that many restaurants don't take your money to guarantee your reservation. And we were discussing of what is their problem. Why do they not do it? Is it cultural? Do they want to be egalitarian? Everybody should have a chance to come, and whether you have $50 to put down, credit towards dinner or not, you still have to wait for half an hour. Is it that they don't get it that we live in a communication society? I don't know. But it only makes a difference if actually there are richer communication mechanisms in addition to collecting the data. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your scarce commodity of giving me your attention and wish you a wonderful second day of Niall's great conference. Thank you.
Next door, we have Case Hardened Web Badges with Kent Brewster from Yahoo. In here, we'll talk about open social with both Google and Hi5 talking about their container strategies.